Hello, and welcome to Ask the Mayor here on WBAA News. I'm your host, Emily Seiberg. This week, we're talking with Crawfordsville Mayor Todd Barton. Thanks so much for being with us. As you're listening, remember, you can always email your questions for any of our show's four mayors to ask, that's A-S-K, at WBAA.org. Welcome to the show, Mayor Barton.
Good afternoon. It's good to be here.
Glad to have you. So on a previous show, we talked about your mayoral salary, which is moving through the approval process of being raised. I wanted to ask, it looks like one of your city council members didn't want to raise council salaries, which I would believe that would be the 2% increase afforded other city employees. That didn't go through, but what was their argument against an increase for city council members?
Well, Councilman Reedy has pointed out he just thinks that the compensation is high enough now and there's no need to raise it. If you look at the, the proposed increase, it is actually more than the 2% that the other employees would be getting. So he's taken issue with that. He's brought it up several times. It appears right now that the council, I mean, if that went to a vote right now, I think it would be 6-1 in favor of the increase for the council. And, you know, the other side of it, the council members have pointed out, look, this hasn't been adjusted since like 2014, 2015, somewhere in there. And, you know, they compared their salaries to like-sized cities around Indiana, and they were at the bottom of the list. And ultimately, the goal, it's kind of like the mayor's salary, is to make sure we're attracting, you know, top talent to be interested in serving, not the people serve for the money, but, you know, you have to make it worth their time at some point. So, I'm sure that that'll come up in second and third reading, but it looks like right now it's, I would say, probably a 6-1 vote.
Would you say the pay has presented, you know, even small issues in the past in terms of attracting council candidates?
Well, I've not had that discussion with anyone, but I know that Councilwoman Jennifer Lowe pointed out that as she's considered whether she will run again, she's approached people about, you know, their interest in the city council and running. And she said, look, I had two conversations in which people, you know, when they ask how much it paid, how many hours are involved, they just said, oh, you know, we're not interested. So she pointed that out. And I think other council members have pointed out similar conversations, but I've not had those conversations.
And I wanted to ask, I mean, even ballpark it, you know, how many hours a week is a city council member, you know, devoting to their duties?
Well, I think that varies. And I think it's, you know, it's just like, you know, in the mayor's role, it is what you make it and it is what you put into it. And, you know, I think there are some council members who put in a lot more time than others. But I do think you have to remember that council members not only just come to a city council meeting and a committee meeting once a month. They, by virtue of what they do, then they have to serve on other boards and commissions and go to other public meetings and those kinds of things. And, you know, some of the council members point out they spend quite a bit of time doing their homework and doing their research. And I think that is reflected by our meetings. I mean, our meetings are typically not very long because everyone has shown up and they've read the material, they've done their research, they've made their phone calls, they've done their homework, and they're ready to discuss and vote. So I don't doubt that the council members spend quite a bit of time preparing.
So how is overall the final 2022 budget looking as we're coursing towards the end of this year.
We are, yeah. It looks really good. And, you know, last year we held the stance that we just held everything flat due to the uncertainties associated with the pandemic and how that would impact our, basically our revenue streams. And, you know, so this year we're trying to kind of make up for that and adjust things that we didn't adjust last year and tweak things. But as I always say, my goal every year is to submit what I call a clean budget to the council. Everything we submit to them is within the funding stream. And if they choose to cut it further, then they certainly can. But I don't go in and have every department walk up there with their wish list and the council has to try to balance this and you know, decide these priorities and sort through. We've done that on the front side. And so what we gave them was very clean and well within the funding stream and clearly well within, you know, our reserves. So the process is going very well, and I don't anticipate really any big adjustments from this point forward in the second and third readings.
And so when do you put a bow on that? When does that finally go through?
Well, it'll go in October. It'll go to second and third readings. We won't really wrap it up until October, November, and that's when we will push it over to the state, because ultimately they have to review it and sign off. And you know, the time that I've been mayor, we've never had negative feedback from the state on our budgets because we give them budgets that are well within our means. You hear of, you know, other governments that get it back and say you need to cut X amount, figure out where to cut it. So we'll go through that approval process with the state. In recent years, they've sped that process up. So we should know, hopefully by the end of this year, our budget's done and in place and approved by the state.
Why do you think that process has sped up? Is that just streamlining processes? You know, what's behind that?
I'm not sure. That's happened, you know, at the state level. You know, I know for, you know, my early years, we typically wouldn't get that notice that the budget had been approved until, you know, late January, February, somewhere in there. And now we typically see that in the first part of December. So I think they've just realized that they have to get it done and get it back to us because, you know, the new year starts on January 1.
It does.
And we have to move forward. So before we were working under the assumption it was going to get approved, but we didn't have it in hand yet.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So
I'm sure they had a lot of feedback from local government. I feel
certain that they did. Yeah. And speaking of spending, I did want to get some updates today on two funding sources, opportunities we've been talking about over the past months. You know, first of all, where are things at with Crawfordsville's plans for how to spend its American Rescue Plan dollars? I know that's been kind of a work in progress for everyone that I've talked to.
It is. Yeah, it has been, and it's still a work in progress. So, you know, the city of Crawfordsville's slated to receive $3.36 million. We've already received $1.68 or half of that, and we've put that in a special account created by the council. And right now we're working through the process of really creating a plan and laying out how we can utilize this funding to have the most impact in our community. So we don't have the answers yet, and that plan is still, I hate to say this, but it's in the early stages. Actually, I have a meeting this afternoon to continue working on this. And for me, the reality is I've spent hours and hours reading this, and it's very confusing. And so we've hired consultants, we've reached out every direction, and there aren't a lot of clear answers. And I think if you look back, this was kind of pushed through Congress rather quickly, and I don't think the guidance was very clear. So, you know, when that happens, everybody puts their spin on it. Everybody reads it through their lens and has their interpretation. Oh, you can do this and you can do that. But I have to see it in black and white, and I have to know that what we're doing is correct. So I'm confident that we will have a plan put together pretty soon. I wish it was ready now, but it's not. And we're going to look at those four broad categories and how you can utilize this to really serve as a catalyst. We're not going to reinvent the wheel or rethink what's happening in this community, but we can certainly take what's already in progress and accelerate it and pick up some of those loose ends that happened because of the pandemic.
So, you know, we're talking about the process and the rollout and some of the confusing elements of this. But at the end of the day, do you appreciate having this funding to spend?
Oh, we do. It's a challenge, but it's a good challenge to have, right? You know, this is unprecedented opportunity. And, you know, I told someone the other day, I said, you know, we went through the Stellar process and that was very time consuming and very involved. And it was a tremendous amount of work. But if you look right now at all these different sources of funding, whether it's the rescue plan or Ready Grant or whatever, you look at all of that, it kind of dwarfs what we did in Stellar, and the workload dwarfs what we had in Stellar. It is a tremendous amount of work, but it's just an unprecedented opportunity to really have a profound impact on our community. So it sounds like I'm kind of crying about it a little bit, but it's a good problem to have. It's just, you know, people have to understand it is a lot of work to move through this.
You are listening to Ask the Mayor on WBAA News. I'm your host, Emily Seiberg, and right now we're talking with Crawfordsville Mayor Todd Barton. So you mentioned this, and this is the second funding stream I wanted to ask about. Where are things at with the application for the Ready Grant? Or we'll use its full name, Regional Economic Acceleration and Development Initiative. I know the state moved the deadline for applications to the end of this month, and know a lot of places are competing for that money.
Right. And so, yeah, we're down to the wire, and that'll go in by the end of the month. And our region has been working diligently on this. We've had, I can't even tell you how many meetings, both in person and virtual. We have a consultant on board that's kind of helping pull it all together and shape the final proposal and, you know, put it in the correct form. And it'll go in on time. We have a meeting, let's see, tomorrow, that will kind of put the bow on everything and wrap it up. And then it's ready to go. So, you know, I'm optimistic about what we're doing. And I think, you know, I don't know what's happening in the other regions, but I can tell you that we have really spent a lot of time. There's been a lot of soul searching as a group. There's been a lot of discussion. We've been brutally honest with one another. And we've really spent time looking at what we were asked to do. And that is, you know, influence economic development as a region through quality of place, quality of life, talent attraction, talent retention, those things. So it's not about hard infrastructure and sewers and those kind of things. They want you to come at this from a different angle, because today jobs follow people. People don't follow jobs. That's just reality. So you're looking at it from a different angle than we're used to looking at it. And I think our region's done a nice job putting a proposal together. You know, it's a compromise. You know, I'm not going to see some of the things in there that I wanted. And there's some things in there that probably wasn't a priority to me, but regionally it's a priority, and that's what we're going to go with.
So when most of the state is essentially trying to make the case that their region should be awarded some of these funds, you know, how do you stand out and make the case that you're more deserving? You know, how have you honed the ask for Crawfordsville?
Well, we've honed it from the regional perspective and for our region, and we're a new region, so that presents some unique challenges, but I think we're going to make a very compelling case. If you look at the census data and you look at where growth is occurring, we are really that next ring of growth, if you will. You know, you have the north side of the metro area, and now you see it moving more to the west and the southwest and kind of working around. So we make a strong case there regionally, and each of the counties involved in our region contribute to that overall growth. And it's coming together very nicely. As part of that consulting group, there's a writer who's putting this together, and I am thoroughly impressed with how he puts things into words. So I'm excited to see the final product.
Can you tell us, I know that when we talked about this before, you mentioned, you know, for example, that housing continues to be a huge priority for you. Can you talk a little bit about your ask? You know, what was in what's in the report that you kind of want, you do want to see happen?
Well, housing is I think pretty much on every county's list. Now, we have different housing needs. Okay, so if you look at, you know, Montgomery and Putnam, we need housing pretty much at every price point. If you look at Boone and Hendricks, they're looking at certain price points and certain segments that they feel like they have a weakness, but overall they're in good shape. So we kind of have to play with that. But housing is a big, big part of every county's proposal. And it's a big, big part of Crawfordsville / Montgomery County's piece. So we know the housing is at the top of the list. And then we step back and we really look at some quality of life initiatives. So in our case, and I can't go into specifics yet until it's released, but you're looking at things like parks and public access to trails and those kinds of amenities that we already have great assets. We just kind of want to take it to the next level. And you have to think of that as a little bit of a regional draw as well. And ultimately, you want people who, you know, they want to live in your community because this is a great place to be.
So I wanted to go ahead and just get an update on how COVID is playing out in your area right now, since we talk once a month. First, are you able to talk a little bit about what's happening with local hospital capacity as that continues to play out, certainly across West Central Indiana?
Right. Well, we were scheduled to have a briefing this morning, and it got postponed because there were just so many conflicting meetings and events happening. So I don't have a latest up-to-date report, but what we do understand is that all of our hospitals are still continuing to run at capacity or near capacity. So continues to be a challenge, continues to be an issue. And, you know, ultimately, I guess I should back up a couple things to think about there. When we say at capacity, you have to understand that capacity has been reduced as well, because the healthcare system itself has been impacted by mm-hmm. shifts in the labor market. And then they lose employees to quarantines and illness, just like every other segment of the economy. So, you know, I know for us, when we talk about capacity in our local hospital, that number is not what it was. You know, total capacity is not what it was, you know, 2 years ago, and it's definitely nowhere close to what it was, you know, 15 years ago. So We have to understand that we have the conversation, but you know, we are just really trying to focus on the next piece, which is how do we improve those vaccination rates, and that is a very complex issue right now that we're going to have to work through, and it's sad, it's unfortunate that we find ourselves in this situation, but the amount of misinformation that's out there about vaccinations is staggering, and it's very difficult to work through.
I was reading, it does look like there has been some kind of week-to-week incremental progress with your vaccination numbers in your county. And more broadly right now, you know, booster shots for a certain portion of the population are likely to roll out soon once that gets final approval. We might see vaccine approval for children starting from age 5 at some right. point in the near future. You know, there we've talked a fair amount about already childhood vaccinations. There are gaps with all vaccinations right now for them. You know, how do you foresee uptake going with this younger group of kids once that becomes a possibility?
Well, I think unfortunately right now, I think it's going to play out exactly like we saw it play out with adults, with their parents or grandparents, right? I mean, you know, the consent for the vaccine is going to come from parents. So, you know, you're going to see a similar reflection when you have children, you know, a similar percentage, I think, because you have, you know, it's just going to play out just like it did with the adult slash parent, because the police aren't going to change that, you know, I don't want it, but I'll get it for my child. I mean, I think you're going to see that across the board. So that's what I think is going to happen there. But we have to do a better job of dispelling this misinformation and getting people to understand that, you know, this is solid medicine here, and this has been researched, and you know, it's very safe and it's very effective. And at this point, that's a tough message to get out there. You are trying to yell to overcome all of the misinformation and negative that's out there.
So heading into the fall and into the winter, and looking at where Delta is at in terms of its peak, you know, and absent the meeting that got canceled this morning, you know, I guess right now, what is the snapshot from the health department? You know, how do they think things look right now, and what are they preparing for?
Well, they're telling us right now that the surge, you know, we're going to see this until probably late last week of October, somewhere in there, and then things will really plateau and start to you know, go down again. That's a change, because they were telling us we were going to see that, you know, late September, early October.
Right.
So they've pushed that back. And that's worrisome to me, but we continue to see, I mean, it's the thing with COVID is it's just so unpredictable, right? So you have the person who barely has symptoms, don't even know they're sick. And then you have the person who ends up on a ventilator, mm-hmm. young people on a ventilator, and sometimes don't make it. It's such a wide range of how it affects people. That's what's so scary. And I think that's what people have to understand. They say, well, I'm young. If I get it, you know, I might get sick for a day or two, but I'll be fine. It's not as bad as getting the vaccine. Well, yeah, the risk from actually having it is much higher than if you get the vaccine.
So a new city position has been created, a communications director. We talked about this a little bit before the show. Has the city ever had someone in a role like this before?
Well, what we did a number of years ago, I recognized that communication is a big piece of what we need to be doing. And it was a strong weakness that we had. And so we hired somebody at the time to kind of split the duty. So they worked with code enforcement and communications. What we found over time is the workload of communications and code enforcement have both grown considerably over the last decade. So we really needed to split that apart to allow that person to focus solely on code enforcement. And then we wanted to bring somebody on for communications. This has been in the works for a couple of 3 years. We've been talking about this and really recognized a dire need to address, you know, communications from several different angles. So we finally, you know, we'd been searching and we finally found the ideal candidate, and we were ready to move forward with this. And, you know, every week we were sitting, reviewing things, saying, oh, we missed another opportunity. We need to be talking about this. We need to be pushing this out. Where people were asking good questions, and we're like, oh, you know, they're asking these questions because we're not getting information out like we should. And we have a great story to tell. We have so much happening, but everybody's busy with their duties, and nobody really has time to make sure that's getting pushed out. So the communications director will be doing that now, and I think it's good. We're already seeing a dramatic change just in a week or two here, and I think people are going to see a big change.
So, how will this change the city's messaging? What kinds of information do you want out there? What are they going to be addressing?
Well, I don't know that it won't change the message, but it will definitely change the frequency and the amount of information that's put out. So the communications director will, basically she's embedded in city government. She's going to see what's happening. She has access to my schedule and to a lot of the meetings. And so, she's going to be picking up saying, oh, hey, there's something there that we need to put out. For example, she's in the department leader meeting, and heard the police chief say, we have two officers graduating from the academy. That's something we need to tell the public, so she puts a press release out about it. You're just going to see much more information coming than you've ever seen, and we don't want to overload people, right? We know that they get bombarded with all this, but we want to make available to the public and to the news media, as much as we can about what's happening in our community. So she's going to be looking at all those things, and our website, I'm the first to tell you, the website has good structure. It looks good, but it's really difficult to keep the content current and fresh and up to date. So she's going to be spending some time on that as well.
So, also speaking of code enforcement, I was reading the city's really going to start zeroing in on its nuisance properties. First, just for the context of this conversation, what is a nuisance property?
Well, I think it's like the old saying, you know it when you see it, right?
Okay.
So, I mean, there are certain properties that are repeat habitual offenders that just don't keep their property up and kind of bring everybody in the neighborhood down. And we're not talking about the person who's struggling, once or twice a year. We're talking about just properties that just many times they're out of town property owners or the people who just don't care. And I tell people, you have to understand, you have 16,000 people living in within a few square miles, and not everybody wants to live the same way. And so you have to have some ground rules, and you have to have some basic principles that you follow. And there are always people who are willing to push that. So there are certain properties that we have been habitually dealing with for years and years. And as part of this change, and I have a person who can full-time focus on code enforcement, pair them up with our legal team. I want these addressed, and we don't want to, we're not playing games with these anymore. The neighbors have been patient, and it's time to address these and make some things happen. So, hopefully, you're going to see some of those problematic ones get addressed pretty soon. And my experience has been once they know you're serious and once they know you're really going to make things happen and do things, they'll start to take it seriously and they'll start to clean them up.
How do these properties usually come to the city's attention?
Oh, 100% by referrals from citizens. You
Okay.
know, we get calls every day, all day. Hey, there's this house in my neighborhood. The yard hasn't been mowed in, 2 months, or there's trash all over the place. I mean, people are calling constantly, and I get it. People take care of their property and they do a nice job, and they have a nice home or a nice neighborhood, and they do all the things they need to do. And then there's one person who will get in the mix who just, puts stuff everywhere and doesn't mow the yard, and houses falling in and trash everywhere. So I understand why they call and why they refer, make complaints, but that's where all that is driven from. We don't necessarily have anybody out just driving around looking for violations. There's so much to do without doing that. And that's what's going on there. But part of it too is really making sure we have the right resources, because sometimes, there it's not the person who's habitual because they want to make a mess. I mean, sometimes we have elderly who can't get out and take care of their property, right? So we need to recognize when that's occurring and get them the right resources to help them fix their property.
So I wanted to ask you about the removal of the Lowhead Dam at Sugar Creek. We talked about this on the show way back at the beginning of this year. It looks like crews got to work on that about 2 weeks ago.
Yes.
So
It's
what?
gone.
It's
It's
gone.
gone. It's
Okay.
gone. Yes. Yeah, so that took about a week to get in there and make that happen.
Okay.
The timing was perfect because the creek was low and we didn't have rain, and they could get in there and do what they needed to do. So the Lowhead Dam has been removed. It was very interesting. We talked about that for like 2 years, kept pushing information out, really ramped it up right before it happened. And I was amazed at how many people then all of a sudden surfaced through social media. I hadn't heard anything about this. What is the deal? What are you doing? So we really, that's a case where having a communications director would have been nice. She was not on board yet. So we spent some time that week really trying to manage misinformation as much as anything, but manage information.
What was the misinformation? Tell me what happened there.
I think people were just confused that, you have to understand that that had been there since 1927.
Yeah.
It's in a lot of people's memories. They remember going there and maybe going fishing there with their grandparents or their parents. And, you have to respect that and understand that. It's a part of their memories. And it's part of the community. But you had to really show them, hey, look, the first question was, have you studied this? Well, we've studied it and studied it and studied it. What is the impact to aquatic life and the biology of the creek? And, is this going to impact flooding? And how did you get them to understand this was not a flood control dam? It was just simply to pool water for cooling. There was a lot of misinformation out there that it was going to drain the creek, further upstream by Darlington and all kinds of things, which absolutely was not true. So we had to refer them to the biologist who had done the study, and he was here that entire week. And I just kept telling people, go down and talk to him. He'll explain this all to you. And Friends of Sugar Creek did a nice job of educating people as well. So I think once people got over that initial shock, they're okay. And what they're going to see, according to the biologist, is a much healthier creek. I was amazed at how many species existed above or below the dam, but not both. And so this should open that.
Okay.
Yeah, I did not think that would happen because you have flooding and stuff. You think that would get mixed up, but it was not. And this will open it up and opens up that entire waterway. So, fish can migrate back and forth, and it should be a much healthier and absolutely a much safer situation. Low head dams are notoriously dangerous, and we're so thankful to remove that threat from our community because, we were knocking on the tragedy had happened there over the years. Mm-hmm. It just had been many, many years, and we were really concerned that it would happen again.
So you have started holding in-person community forums again, which you stopped doing last year due to the pandemic. Have people been showing up? And what are you hearing at these forums? Are these forums perhaps yielding a few new topics than they did before the pandemic?
It's interesting. It's a different crowd. It's a different group, which I find interesting.
Okay.
And the first couple I've done three now, all three of them I've done outside. So I've kept them outside where we, can have the distancing and, keep it safe. The first two were really high numbers, quite a few people there. I think there was kind of a pent-up demand.
Mm-hmm.
Did one last night, not a very high number, but the weather was pretty bad too. So yeah, it's been interesting.
Okay, we will talk more about that on the next show. Thanks so much for being with us, Mayor.
Thank you.
That is our time for today, and you can find this program at our website, wbaa.org, along with an archive of our shows with the mayors of Lafayette, West Lafayette, Crawfordsville, and Frankfort. Send us your questions to ask@wbaa.org. Thanks for listening and have a great rest of the day.